listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guts could hold the key to preventing disease in the future. We'll talk to a researcher about our internal ecosystem and how it could help prevent or treat chronic illnesses that can raise our health risks. Now, COVID-19 has disrupted lives and killed hundreds of thousands of people across the country. But data from the Centers for Disease Control shows that around 80% of people who get the illness have mild or moderate symptoms. WPR's Laura Pavin was in that second group of people. And with the help of some experts, she explored why that might have been harder than she expected.
Positive for COVID-19. That's what my lab results read. I was surprised. I felt totally normal. But I told everyone who needed to know. Only, I forgot one person. And he was now in the emergency room with COVID. I didn't know how to tell him, and I wasn't sure if I should tell him. This dilemma is real, and it's making the pandemic harder to control.
So we often see messaging, especially from elected officials, about this is not hard, stop whining, don't be selfish, don't be reckless.
That's Julia Marcus. She's an infectious disease epidemiologist at Harvard Medical School.
My concern is that when people do test positive, that then they immediately feel like, oh, I must have been irresponsible. And that makes people afraid to disclose. So it actually ends up making the pandemic more difficult to contain.
For the record, I did end up telling the man that I had COVID. It was hard. Actually, everything about being COVID positive was difficult. Because isolating from my 9-month-old daughter wasn't an option for me, she had to quarantine and stay out of daycare longer than the normal 2 weeks. My husband and I work remote, so we made it work. But in a small apartment, it was stressful. It left my husband, Jake Connors, wondering.
It makes me think about what are other people going to do in a less advantageous situation when they're hit with that type of stuff. You know, we're lucky to be salaried employees. If you're not a salaried employee, why would you go get tested?
In other words, if you get paid by the hour and you get a positive test result, there goes that source of income. And in the likely event that your child has to stay home from school or daycare as a result, double whammy. But could this actually be deterring people from getting tested? I talked to Joffrey Swain. He's a recently retired UW public health professor. He headed up the Milwaukee Health Department for 26 years.
We do have significant data to suggest that not enough people are getting tested.
When we talked in late December, he said that only about half of Wisconsin's testing capacity was being used. The other indication that not enough people are getting tested?
Our positivity rate is high. So what it means is probably only the most serious cases are getting a test, and not enough people who have mild cases are getting a test.
Figuring out why is harder to pin down. Access to testing could be a reason. Being asymptomatic could be another. But some of it might be more nuanced. Kathleen Murphy-Endy, a clinical psychologist at UW Health, offered some insight from her own practice.
I think we sometimes underestimate the impact of finances on people's behavior with COVID. People don't have sick leave, perhaps. Maybe they can't take the time off work. Some people feel that no one has the right to tell them what to do.
Sometimes the reasons are more personal.
I think there's the guilt of having the possibility of infecting others. The thought of that guilt is pretty tremendous.
The federal government has depended on states to take the lead on controlling the virus. And experts say that's made it harder to control. Julia Marcus, the Harvard epidemiologist, says that now it feels like personal responsibility is what will save us. So we've resorted to shaming others for not following all the public health guidance around COVID, for being reckless. She says this isn't an effective way to change behaviors. All it does is drive it underground. I can attest to that. I didn't tell anyone when we ended my daughter's quarantine a few days early so that her grandparents could help watch her. We were struggling and needed support. We weighed the risks with the grandparents and collectively decided it was best for our family. On its face, following public health guidance around COVID sounds as simple as staying in and avoiding other people. But dismissing it as simple fails to consider the very human reasons why people act in other ways. I'm Laura Pavin.
Now, Governor Evers has released a budget proposal aimed at making prescription drugs more affordable. The governor said in a statement, quote, "No Wisconsinite should have to choose between paying their bills and affording their prescription medication." The wide-ranging proposal includes measures that would put a $50 cap on insulin copayments, import drugs from other countries where they're less costly, and increasing funding for free clinics that provide medication for low-income patients. We're checking out the details, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you had trouble paying for medications you need? What kind of things would help you? Do you use insulin in particular? Is it affordable for you? What kind of things would you like to see done to tackle prescription drug costs? And if you work anywhere in the supply chain for a drug company, at a pharmacy, or at a pharmacy benefits manager, love to hear your perspective on the cost of medications. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Chimaine Mills is WPR's health reporter. Chimaine, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, before we get into what is in these proposals, let's talk about where it is and the timing. This is part of the governor's budget proposal. Long story short, this is not something that's going to happen real fast, right?
No. If you've ever followed the budget in past years, you know it's a long, drawn-out process. It starts with the governor. He writes his budget, his wish list, what he'd like to see the state spend money on. Then it goes to the legislature. And as you know, the legislature is dominated by Republicans. They have their own spending priorities, which may or may not agree with the governor's spending priorities. They try and hash out their differences, and eventually you come up with a budget many months later.
Well, let's start digging into the details of what we did hear from the governor. I mentioned insulin, and we hear a lot in the news about this being really a life or death drug for people dealing with certain kinds of diabetes and being very expensive for some people. What kind of things would the governor's plan do for insulin in particular?
Well, his plan deals with bringing down costs not only for the state. For instance, the state buys drugs for employees, inmates, those who are on Medicaid. But the governor's plan also would try to control costs for individuals, and specifically, as you mentioned, capping the copays on insulin. This is a widely used drug. It can be very, very expensive. A year or two ago, there was nationwide outrage when people were paying exorbitant costs for their insulin, along with other items like inhalers. And Congress tried to do something about it, and then the pandemic came. So the issue has kind of been sidelined on a national level because of focus on the pandemic.
On a related note, one piece of the governor's proposal harkens back to something you covered almost exactly a year ago, having to do with pharmacy benefits managers. This was in the legislature. Seems like it got derailed maybe by COVID. What are these PBMs, pharmacy benefit managers, and what kind of changes might be in the works here?
Yeah, this is just one element of the supply chain and one reason why it's so hard to find a solution for controlling drug costs. Pharmacy benefit managers are commonly called the middlemen. I'm using air quotes now. What they do is they negotiate prices between the drug makers and those that are buying the drugs, hospitals, and others. So they, because they're negotiating, take a cut. Problem is, we, the public, don't know what the details of these deals are. So there's a lot of money being exchanged hands, and this can result in higher drug prices. So the bill would have provided some transparency to that process. The Office of Insurance, the state regulator, would license these pharmacy benefit managers and just try and regulate them so that it could tamp down prescription drug prices.
At the national level, Chimaine, sometimes we hear proposals saying, hey, we need to be able to import drugs from other companies when there isn't enough competition, for example, in the U.S. to help keep prices down. The governor inches toward that a little bit. What is he proposing there?
Well, this wouldn't be all drugs. This would be some drugs, those that don't have competitors. And bringing in drugs from other countries sounds good. They're cheaper in other places like Canada. It's not easy, though. You have to go through federal, several steps with the federal government. You need approval from the feds before you can do this. So it's not something that's quickly said and done. It's a long process.
So what conditions, again, under this plan, which would have to be approved by the legislature, in what conditions would those drugs be able to be imported?
Well, first, the governor would have to get approval from the legislature. If this is part of his budget, it would need to be signed off by Republicans. And this is something that Republicans previously said they didn't want to do. In the last budget, Republicans said, no, we don't want to do this. So here the governor is reintroducing it. Maybe Republicans will change their mind this time because there is a lot of public pressure to bring down prescription drug prices. And this is one way to do it. There are a number of individuals who are currently getting drugs from other countries. The government has sort of looked the other way. It's not legal, but they're doing it to try and get medication they need. So it remains to be seen if this will go anywhere. Right now, I was told by AARP Wisconsin that there are several states that have taken the steps to do this, but they have not yet gotten approval from the federal government. So who will be the first remains to be seen.
We're talking to WPR health reporter Shemaine Mills about Governor Evers' budget plans aimed at reducing prescription drug costs. We'll check out some more of the details, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on these proposed changes, your questions about what they involve. Do you use insulin? Do you think a cap on insulin copayments is a good idea? Pharmacists, healthcare professionals, what are your thoughts on the cost of prescription drugs? What would you want to see from the state government when it comes to prescription drug affordability? Share your thoughts, questions, and experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with WPR health reporter Shemaine Mills on the governor's proposal to boost prescription drug affordability. He has plans that he'll include in his state budget proposal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had trouble affording prescription drugs, or maybe someone in your family has? Are there changes you'd like to see in the system to try to control costs? And if you work in this line of work, let us know what you're seeing at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Carrie is with us in Sparta. Carrie, hello.
Hello. You know, I've been on insulin for quite a while and watched the prices go absolutely astronomical. I believe this is all to do with who's getting their pockets lined at the time. You know, lobbyists have to have some money to work with, and a $600 pack of insulin is just going to go into their pockets, which is going to go into our legislatures. What they need is more regulation on what the lobbyists can do and what these pharmacies can do. The people who are – there's plenty of it. They never patented it. He just let it to everyone who would make it, but they regulate it so much that now we can't get it.
Carrie, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Shemaine, Carrie, talk about the influence of pharmaceutical companies, but then insulin, again, this seems like one of those prescription products that's gotten a lot of attention, Shemaine.
It definitely has, and seven states have capped insulin copays during the pandemic. That's how big an issue this is. Wisconsin is not one of those states. We did have a bill in the last session introduced by a Democratic lawmaker, but it didn't go anywhere. So there have been proposals to cap the cost of insulin, but they haven't gone anywhere. And part of the governor's proposal would create this board that would regulate prices, not just insulin, but create some barriers for how high you could go, create a ceiling. Now that, of course, is just a proposal. We'll see where it goes, but there are efforts to try and get these costs under control.
Thanks a lot for that call, Carrie, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Dan now in West Allis. Dan, hi.
Hi. Yeah. I've been calling this morning, or I heard this morning on the Ideas Network, that other countries treat their medical system like a utility, and it's all regulated by the government. So everything is price capped. You know what you're going to pay before you get there. It just makes sense. The free market economy in our medical system is just, it's an epic failure.
Dan, thanks for the call. Shamin, Governor Evers' plan doesn't go, I think, where Dan is hoping it would go compared to other countries. These are, in the scope of things, not huge changes in our healthcare system being proposed here. Do you think that's fair to say?
Exactly. I mean, our market is designed to work so that it's competitive, and ideally that would keep prices down. But that isn't always the case. And in other countries, the government has stepped in. Now, that is not what is happening here. We're kind of nibbling at the edges. In the past, you've had action at the federal level. For instance, there was a federal drug plan under George Bush. They realized that they needed to get lower prices for seniors. This effort is a little broader, but there's recognition that people are having trouble affording needed medication, so something needs to be done.
Dan, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Shamin Mills, WPR health reporter, looking at plans from the governor. He'll include them in his next budget proposal aimed at reducing the costs or limiting the costs of certain prescription drugs. Still time for your call with your questions, your thoughts, and maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Another piece of this puzzle in these proposals, Shamin, the governor looking to use the buying power, combining different places where the government is paying for prescriptions to try to use that as leverage for bargaining power. What would that look like?
Right. You hear about this often, you know, having a large group to use that leverage and bring down prices. That is why large employers get better prices on drugs and their healthcare, and why healthcare and medication is so expensive for the individual, because you're paying the sticker price as opposed to a negotiated price that can drive that down. And that would save taxpayers money too. If the state can buy drugs in bulk for a number of programs, that'll bring prices down.
And which programs would this plan bring together to harness that negotiating power, I guess?
Well, right now, we're buying different for inmates, for employees. So try and bring that all together under one roof would leverage that power.
Thanks. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. So timeline here, Shamin, we'll get to in just a minute as we wrap up. You also spoke with some pharmacists about these proposals. What kind of things did they tell you?
Well, a pharmacist I talked to in Baraboo said, frankly, there's just not much regulation of drug prices, so companies can charge what they want. And she herself questioned, why does Canada have lower prices? She agrees that drug makers should be reimbursed for the research costs. But she said there's a limit. Consumers need to be able to afford their medication.
Let's go back to our callers now. John is with us in Elkhorn. John, hi.
Yeah, I get medicine. I have AIDS. And the medicine that I need, just my cost, is over $6,000 a month. And so in order, like this year, at the beginning of the year, my insurance is $7,000 out of pocket. So I had to apply to a foundation in Madison, and which I got approved, and they help pay the copay. And then once it's paid up, well, it gets covered by February, then the insurance covers it for the rest of the year. But if you didn't have insurance, if it wasn't for Obamacare for me to get insurance, I would be not able to get my medicine at all.
John, thanks for that call. Shamin, is there anything in the governor's proposals about those very expensive, in this case, AIDS medication, very expensive medications that people rely on?
No, there isn't. It deals with insulin copays, but John's question brings up an important point in that having insurance is great, but some of the deductibles are in the thousands of dollars. So that's a barrier right there. It sounds like his medication is very expensive and he has to buy a lot of medication before he gets to that point the insurance kicks in. And that's part of a larger problem where many people don't get to that point. We have a lot of free clinics and programs which are helping people out get the medication, but it points to that larger problem of insurance in and of itself is not the answer, not when there's a large deductible.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Paul is with us in Beaver Dam. Paul, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to discuss how the free market can't possibly work in the medical marketplace. And in this case, we're talking about drugs, but it really extends to the entire thing. Now, a free market requires multiple suppliers and multiple buyers, and it has to have a decision point at which the supply and demand balance. Now, in the medical marketplace, the buyers look at it not from which is the most expensive or the least expensive and who should I buy from. They look at it like, I'm going to live or I'm going to die. That's
Paul,
not a free market.
I'm going to jump in, Paul. Thanks. We're just about out of time. Thanks for calling in. Shemaine, again, the timeline, when will this be formally unveiled in the governor's budget? And well, I won't ask you to predict when the budget will be signed off on.
Well, February 16th is when the governor will produce his budget. And he's already said he wants to lower prescription drug prices, a couple other items in there he's already announced. He'd like to see more broadband access. And then also, I'm forgetting what else. Oh, unemployment system. He wants to improve the system for unemployment payments. So prescription drugs, unemployment fixes, and those are going to be in the budget, which will come out February 16th.
Shemaine, thanks for joining us again.
You bet.
That's WPR Health reporter Shemaine Mills looking at prescription drug proposals from Governor Evers. Coming up, we'll find out how our guts, our microbiomes, could help us stay healthier, even during a pandemic. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, a scientist and her team have demonstrated that one part of our body could be a big indicator of how severe our COVID-19 symptoms might be, and that's our gut. Turns out that our microbiome, the bacteria and other microorganisms in our gut, plays a big role in the overall health of our bodies, including supporting our immune system's response to viral infection as well. Our next guest has written about her interest in investigating interactions between diet, microbiome, and immunity, including a recent piece for The Conversation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this works, this microbiome? Do you have questions about the work our guest team is doing to study immunity and chronic disease? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ana Maldonado Contreras is an assistant professor in the Department of Microbiology and Physiological Systems at the University of Massachusetts. She's co-founder of the Center for Microbiome Research and is interested in understanding the interaction of diet, the microbiome, and disease. Ana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Now, thank you so much for the invitation.
Well, I've been throwing that word around, microbiome. Tell us what that is, please.
Yeah, it's a handful, isn't it? So the microbiome is just the composition or the group of bacteria, not just only bacteria, but also fungi and viruses that live in and on us. And when I say in, usually it's like in our gut and another mucosa places in our body, but also in our skin. And we have discovered in the past 20 years that we are actually very much populated by them.
And I think a lot of times when we hear bacteria and virus, the high-profile ones are ones that do bad things to us. Most of these guys who live inside us, right, they're good for us.
Yeah, exactly. We have a wage at war against bacteria and viruses, because the prominent ones, the ones that make us sick, they really make us sick and they really cause an impact. But the good ones seem to be silently working towards making us healthy. So you are completely right. These huge trillions of bacteria, I'm going to refer most in bacteria because it's when we are study the mouse. The trillion of bacteria living in our bodies are mostly beneficial and actually help us to train our immune system to digest foods that we couldn't digest by ourselves because we don't have the proper tools to break down some of the foods that we ingest. So just understanding that relationship of this huge universe of bacteria that live on us is what keeps me awake at night.
Now, these bacteria, and again, you say mostly bacteria, they live in our gut, a lot of them. And I understand, it makes sense that they help us digest our food. I get that. But it seems like we keep learning, including your research, they're doing a lot more than just being our digestive system, right? What kind of things are we finding that they do for us?
Yeah. So, and some of the research that I'm focusing right now is in how they train our immune system. So we have, there are studies that have seen in animals, we cannot do that in humans, but they call germ-free animals. So are these animals that are born without any bacteria, that are completely sterile. And those animals have a deficient immune system. They're actually the barriers that protect us from pathogens are debilitated. And if we colonize those, in this case are mostly mice, with these beneficial bacteria, then they get primed, they get like trained, and then they create a robust response against them pathogens and defend us from that. And that's what we're trying to understand, because, you know, the excessive use of antibiotics, for example, or the increased use of C-section, elective C-section, not the ones that are medically, necessary, seems to be really lowering the diversity and having a dent on the diversity of these microbiomes. So I should say that one of the ways that we measure that this is a healthy microbiome, there's this healthy bacteria community, is by the diversity. So having a very different box that the bacteria that do different jobs actually makes us more healthy.
We're talking to Ana Maldonado Contreras from the University of Massachusetts, co-founder of the Center for Microbiome Research, talking about the relationship between the healthy ecosystem, hopefully healthy ecosystem in our guts and all the bacteria and other stuff in there doing work for us and our overall health. Okay, Ana, up till about a year ago, a lot of your research was focusing on this environment in our gut and various kinds of chronic conditions, diabetes, obesity, and more. What kind of things were you finding out there?
So I'm interested in this. The research has been done already. My lab is interested in how shaping that altered ecosystem, as you call it, that I think is right on point. How can we change this ecosystem to increase diversity and to actually favor the bacteria that we know are beneficial from our health? So there has been a lot of research on these chronic diseases, and we see again and again and again that those chronic diseases are related to this altered composition of the microbiota and this altered immune system that is sometimes overreacting against ourselves. So how can we shift that? It's an ecological question. How can we plant more trees in this ecosystem? And so for that, I use diet. And I'm very interested in how diet can change the microbiome and understanding specific foods and components of the foods that can target a specific bacteria that we're looking at. So diet, and we have learned that diets have to be personalized, is actually also a very behavioral change. So as close as we get to understanding, is carrot versus potatoes versus pasta versus tomato, then we can have some personalized dietary guidelines to train physicians so they can help their patients to eat healthier and depending on their food preferences.
Okay.
And so that's that's what my job has been centered, and I study mainly inflammatory bowel diseases.
So I understand this is a complicated system, and Rob's gut ecosystem might be different than Anna's. So, you know, one size might not fit all. That said, exactly. Are there general dietary things that we could all be thinking about that for most of us, maybe all of us, are probably going to help boost that diversity of good stuff?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, again, this research is in infancy, but I will tell you what I eat. So I eat a lot of nuts. I eat a lot of lean meat, mostly fish, vegetables at least 3 times per day, fruits. So a variety of foods that are lower in fat and that are rich in fiber. Fiber seems to be the key to that's what the wood bacteria like to eat, fiber. And where do you find that? You find it in oatmeal. You find it in chia seeds. You find it in vegetables, in fruits. And so that's what I did. So that will be my advice.
And that sounds like great news, Anna, because I've talked to cardiologists on the show, and they say to eat those foods you just said. And people talk about preventing Alzheimer's and things like that. These are things we already know are healthy in other ways. So that's nice to know, right, that they reinforce our gut bacteria as well.
Well, and that's, we believe that that's the connection, actually. So there is an underlying inflammation in patients, for example, with cardiovascular diseases. So feeding the good bacteria would actually help to lower that inflammation and then to have, reduce the episodes later in life. So everything seems to be connected to the same pathways. And that's why the foods are very similar. But that is easier said than done. And as you know, just changing their diet is a huge behavioral change. So what we're trying to do also is to teach patients how to cook. I think we're growing far and farther from our kitchen. So you know, it's just easier to grab what is on a food and fast food restaurant. It's cheaper. You will think it's cheaper actually than if you think about the long term consequences. It's not as cheap as you think. So we're also have a teaching kitchen, for example, at UMass, where we teach patients what to eat and how to cook that the food that we're telling them what to eat. So they're also going to the grocery store. Sometimes if you go in automatic and you go to the same aisles. So we believe that our research is going from understanding the molecular mechanism of how this food interact with your gut epithelial cell and your bacteria, but also then how can we make a behavioral change that it can be sustained for long term and patients can eat this food for life.
We're talking to Anna Maldonado Contreras, assistant professor of microbiology and physiological systems, co-founder of the Center for Microbiome Research at the University of Massachusetts. We are talking about the lively ecosystem that lives in our guts and the health benefits it can have if we take good care of it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you eat with your gut health in mind? Do you do some of the things our guest was talking about? Do you take supplements or other foods that are supposed to help your microbiome? Do you have a question for our guest about her research? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Coming up, we'll get into our guest's latest research on how all this connects to resistance to diseases like COVID-19. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Anna Maldonado Contreras, co-founder of the Center for Microbiome Research, also a microbiology professor at the University of Massachusetts. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about health, well-being, and the bacteria in our guts. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mary is with us in Mount Horeb. Mary, hi.
Hi. Yes, I have a question. I am 52, and I went through the change that we do at this around this time, and I thought I was going to be spared because I eat healthy and I work out from the, I guess it's called like the menopause pouch or the weight gain that happens And I'm wondering if from your experience, if there's anything age related, like changes in the biomes and whatnot, and the hormonal changes and everything that is associated with that, and different choices I can make as far as what I eat to help counter that.
Mary, thanks for the call. Anna, thoughts on aging and changing biome, weight gain, and menopause?
Oh, thank you for that question. That's a great question. And we do see differences in our microbiota as our body changes and age. The role of hormones in those changes are understudied, I will have to say. But we do believe that have to be they have to do something with the way that the microbiota is shaped up. So I'm not a nutritionist, and actually I'm not actually a doctor. I won't give you any advice. Again, I will just tell you what I eat. and what we have been doing in our research, for example, we're starting to focus on woman health, and we are actually doing interventions in pregnant women with Crohn's disease to look at how we can change with perinatal diet, the microbiota of what the baby is receiving from their mom. So to that specific listener, I can, again, eat, I think I, the eat healthy advice is the only thing I can give you. And more research about aging, you're absolutely right. We change, our body change, and also our microbiota seems to be changing and sometimes get weaker most of the time.
Thanks for the call, Mary. We'll go to Henry now in Madison. Henry, hello.
Hi. So I've actually heard about research that connects stress levels to microbiota health. And I was wondering if you knew, or could give a real bird's eye view mechanism for how that worked, or if there were any specific foods that would help more than others.
Henry, thanks for the call. What do we know about microbiome and our stress, Anna?
Oh yeah, that's yeah. Now there is a huge boom of the gut brain axis and how our microbiota can. You know, there are papers and more research coming on how the microbiota can even change our mood. You know, they're still, again, in infancy, and there is a lot to be learned on that sense. There is a lot of studies that have been done in rats and mice on that end, and it seems to be changing. If you change your microbiota, a response to stress does change. And the disease that I study in the lab, which is inflammatory bowel disease, there is a very strong connection with having a stress and then a flare up, and which means, you know, huge symptoms, constant diarrhea, and very, very debilitating symptoms. So we're still learning about that. It does seem to have an effect there, but we don't know still. The question is... the egg at the chicken question. What is it first? If is the stress that triggers that changes in the microbiota, or just having an unhealthy microbiota triggers stress? So it seems to be, and again, we're still looking into that, but that even people with stress and people with some, and there's very novel and recent research, even with depression, seems to have, again, this underlying subclinical inflammation that seems to be related to this altered gut microbiome.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Anna Maldonado Contreras, co-founder of the Center for Microbiome Research, about our guts and our overall well-being. All right, Anna, I said up to a year ago you were researching chronic conditions. Now, COVID-19 comes along. The people most at risk have some of the same chronic conditions that you study: diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular problems. What did you pivot your research toward when it came to COVID-19 and these underlying conditions?
Yeah, and a little bit of background. So I got to this, my office is in this medical school of UMass, which is one of the top medical school in the country. And when I got to pick up my belongings to start working from home, you know, you see the lobby was completely empty. So I felt very defeated as a scientist and as a person that is trying to solve problems for humanity and diseases caused by microbes. So I decided, what can I do? And that plus then the nascent news of these patients having more severe symptoms for COVID disease, the comorbidities that were associated with it, like you say, were chronic disease that I know that are associated with an altered microbiota, cardiovascular diseases, type 2 diabetes, obesity. So in those diseases, one of the main risk factors to develop those diseases is poor diet. It's incredible that how revolutionary can be just having a healthy diet in daily. So in what we see for example for Crohn's disease is just that these microbes actually exacerbate an immune response. The body overreact against itself and against other bacteria, and that's exactly what's happening with the severe COVID-19 patients. It wasn't the virus itself killing the patient. It was like the overreactive, most of the patients that die have an overreactive immune system that was then targeting their own cells, and then they start having organ failure. So I start putting the pieces of the puzzle together. So we have these communities that are, in America, half of our adult population suffer from these chronic diseases. Our diet is very poor, and then we get hit with this virus, violent virus, that then activates our immune system, and us that are debilitated with these chronic diseases plus a bad microbiome can have this overreaction. So that was the rationale behind the study that I started putting together. And then we ended up seeing that indeed we recruited patients, hospitalized patients in our clinics, in our hospital, and looking at differences in the microbiome for people that have very severe symptoms, those severe symptoms that I'm telling you that seems to be of an overreacted immune system, and the patients that do have symptoms, but it was a moderate and then survive and went along with their life. And we did see very marked difference in the composition of the microbiota. And we also could identify using very sophisticated mathematical modeling that has been validated for other studies, that we can identify a specific bacteria, like one bacteria that can be cultured, that is a very good predictor of disease severity, of COVID-19 severity.
So, Anna, in our last minute, I mean, it sounds like this could be a big long-term public health intervention for future diseases, maybe making sure people have access to affordable, healthy food. Is this part of what you're hoping for, a takeaway from your research?
That's what I'm here. That's what I'm here, and that's what I write in the conversation besides peer-reviewed journals. I do really believe that policies that help have access to fresh foods and into healthy foods instead of and fast foods, as I call it, a very processed food, will make a key in changing the way we eat and in our health. And the investment that we do up front will pay in the long run, because we will reduce healthcare costs. I mean, the chronic diseases is a huge budgetary hole in our healthcare system. So yeah, that's what I firmly believe, that we need to have policies in place to have access to fresh foods and to healthy foods.
Anna, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
No, thank you so much.
That was Anna Maldonado Contreras, assistant professor in the Department of Microbiology and Physiological Systems at the University of Massachusetts. She's also a co-founder of the Center for Microbiome Research. She joined us for a look at our guts, our microbiomes, what it all means for disease resistance, chronic diseases, and maybe even our ability as a society to deal with a pandemic like COVID-19. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, a Wisconsin poverty researcher joins the show for a look at the impact of a stagnant minimum wage and what potential increases could mean for the economy. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, since Joe Biden won the presidency, Republican lawmakers in states around the nation have been trying to change election laws. We'll look at the proposals on the table and their potential impact in future elections. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.